It's now my pleasure on your behalf to call on Brother Clyde Snowland to give us those most necessary words of exhortation. Brother Clyde.
Good morning, everyone. When Brother Mike asked me to fill in for him this morning, my first response was to check the three daily readings. And quite frankly, I was troubled. And when I read the three of them, and then I thought, well, you know, this is probably the way it's supposed to be, as much as we don't like it. If we're not somehow troubled, it seems to me, with every chapter of Scripture that we read, then we're missing the point, because this is what it's all about, isn't it? It's about change. It's about us looking at these incidents and these accounts and seeing how we measure up, or seeing what the lesson is for us and how we can apply that to our life. And if we haven't done that, as I say, I'm sure we've sort of missed it. And a lot of the things that we read about and learn about are not nice things. They're really not things that we really sort of naturally take to at all. And so there's a bit of a resistance. I wouldn't say it's a bit of a resistance. It's a major resistance that most of us have, and just kind of, you know, reading the good bits and the bits that we sort of relate to, and sort of skimming over the other bits that we sort of don't. So we have kind of a cut and paste response a lot of the time to what we read, and I'm very much guilty of that myself. So let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 9, and we're going to look at all three of them, God willing, this morning, of the readings, because I think there's a very, very strong message that comes out. Now, in 1 Kings chapter 9, we sort of have the summary of this great temple that Solomon built. This wasn't just any normal temple. The temple, of course, was built, as chapter 9 tells us, and was consecrated so that God's name could be put there. This was the eternal creator of the heavens and the earth, the eternal immortal God of Israel, who had determined that his people would be the light-bearing nation on earth. And so therefore, this amazing, spectacular temple, which had to be one of the great wonders of the ancient world, was put there in the strategic spot in Jerusalem so that the world could see. So that people traveling from up in Syria and the area of the Hittites down into Egypt and back and forth through Africa and Asia could go by and say, you know, that's where the eternal God of heaven lives. 1 Kings chapter 9 and verse 3, he lives there. His name's there. Like, it's the name of the God of Israel, right? And not only that, but apart from the fact that it was an amazing piece of architecture, I'm sure that there was a miraculous presence there. Probably the pillar of cloud during the day and the pillar of fire by night. So there was no question. When you walk by this place, or when you went by this place, that something very special was going on there. And again, this was no normal temple. 1 Kings chapter 6 gives some of the description. Chapter 5 gives some of the description. Chapter 5 and verse, actually from chapter 4 through to chapter 9 give us some of the descriptions and bits and pieces of this temple, including the fact that the outer sanctuary, that is the inside, the large piece of the sanctuary, was lined with cedar from Lebanon. It says from floor to ceiling, if we check out chapter 6 and verse 18. Not only was it lined with cedar from floor to ceiling, but it was carved intricately with gourds and flowers. This was a work of art. It wasn't just good lumber. The inner sanctuary, where the ark was lined with pure gold. This is a big room, too. There's a lot of wealth here. Of course, gold was associated with Solomon's reign. As a matter of fact, silver was so plentiful and abundant that nobody even bothered with it. Gold was associated with Solomon's reign. There were 30,000 laborers sent off to Lebanon in three shifts, we read in 1 Kings chapter 5 and verse 13. The shifts were basically month-long shifts, so they worked 2 months in Lebanon, and they had a month at home. So they had three shifts of 10,000 laborers each. It's a pretty sizable workforce. There were 70,000 carriers. These were the folks who moved all the materials around. 80,000 stone cutters. And this was mentioned on Thursday evening. The stone cutters quarried all the rock off-site, and then they carried it quietly to the site. 3,300 foremen, 1 Kings 5 and 17. And let's go to chapter 8, 1 Kings chapter 8 and verse 27. And Solomon understood that with all of this massive piece of architecture and all of this building that was going on, it really wasn't enough. It really wasn't what it should be. In verse 27 of chapter 8, he says, but will God really dwell on earth? We're going to build this temple and God's going to live there? It's almost, he couldn't accept that, really. I mean, how could we say, well, we're going to put God in some box somewhere, even though it was a cedar gold box? Can't do that. The heavens, even the highest heavens, cannot contain God who created all things. How much less this temple that I have built? So there was an agreement on Solomon's part that this was really quite an inadequate place, when all was said and done, for God to dwell. God's name was there, chapter 9 and verse 3. My eyes, he says, in chapter 9, verse 3, and my heart will always be there. Now that's a statement of eternal truth. Apart from the fact that he also told Solomon that I'll be there as long as you do what you're told, as long as the nation does what it's told. But if you get into that other stuff, you know, idolatry and so on, I'm going to have to leave you. And he talks to them about that. I'm going to have to pull out. Chapter 9, verse 6 to 9, it came with a qualification. It's all very well to say you have this beautiful building, but if you don't measure up, then it will not become a wonder of the world. It'll become a point of derision and ridicule. So that was a solemn warning that went with this. But in any case, on the one hand, we find in chapter 9 that Solomon spent 20 years building. But the sad part of it is, if we go back to chapter 6, in the last verse of chapter 6, it said he spent 7 years building it, that is the temple, this amazing temple. But in the NIV in chapter 7, verse 1, there's a however there. And I know we've all read this before, but this is the impacting thing to me. When it says it took Solomon 13 years, however, to complete the construction of his own palace. Now that is the troubling thing, of course, because while he spent 7 years on the Lord's house, he spends 13 on his own. And that's a great struggle that we all have, isn't it, in terms of the focus of our own lives and the priorities of our own lives. And I know we talk about balance from time to time, but this clearly isn't balance. It clearly indicates to us that the Lord always gets sort of the less time, not the more. We spend 7 years on the Lord's house, but nearly twice as much time on our own. And often it's even more than that. And it's a very, very subtle thing. Very, very subtle thing. But that's the way we are. It's the way we think. It's the way we're made. And this is the great lesson. Now, I know that we could throw into that the fact that Solomon says, oh, well, you know, I married Pharaoh's daughter. You know the type of buildings they have in Egypt and those houses that the gals live in Egypt. I got to do something nice for her. But that's really the problem, you see. We're really going in the wrong direction. His own house, his own issues, his own pressures were far greater than the concerns of God's house. And then, of course, the end of the story really is in chapter 11, where he ends up with not just one queen from Egypt, but 1,000 women in the house. So it is a huge warning for us, isn't it, that it is so easy for us to get kind of bent out of shape on these things. And really what the Lord needs is all of us, not a percentage, not the small percentage. And as Brother Stephen mentioned in his prayer this morning, quite appropriately, that, you know, we need to give all. We need to worship the Lord with all that we have. And we need to continually plead, as he mentioned in his prayer, that God won't depart from us like he did from the temple. It's a huge lesson. Now, in contrast to that, let's go over to Jeremiah 35. Now, there's a somewhat obscure group of folks here in Jeremiah 35 called the Rechabites, and they just kind of appear here in Jeremiah's sort of narrative about what was going on As the Babylonians were sweeping down into Jerusalem and into Judah in a series of sort of waves of invasion, and there was a bit of negotiation going on during these times, primarily with the elders of Israel or Jerusalem and Judah. And Jeremiah is told by God to get together the Rechabite family, verse 2, and to bring them into the main buildings of the temple, and to sit down with the elders and the Rechabites and have a drink, which was a nice sociable thing to do. The problem was that the Rechabites didn't drink. They weren't teetotalers, but they didn't drink. And not only that, but they hadn't touched any alcohol for hundreds of years, at least, as far as we know. And so they refused. They said, no, we can't. We can't have a drink. We can't drink with these guys in the temple because we've got a covenant. Our family hasn't done this for, hundreds of years. And actually, these Rechabites, as far as we know, were related to Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. Interestingly enough, they were Midianites. And what we read about them, probably the only other prominent time, is when they sided with Jehu. You remember when Jehu set about to purge the nation of Israel from the worshippers of Baal. And they were there. It doesn't say a whole lot about them, but it does say that they were there. This Jonadab, the son of Rechab, who allied himself with Jehu. And they'd been there for a long time. And they'd made a covenant with the Lord to dwell in tents, to live kind of this very simple life, and to abstain from alcohol. Now, of course, when they refused, the whole point of this was not to try and make them break their covenant. The whole point of this was so that they could sit down with the elders of Jerusalem and Jeremiah could say, well, there's an example of some folks who made a covenant and they stayed with it. They have acknowledged and stayed true to the covenant of their fathers, and they've lived this simple life, and the focus that they've had is on the Lord's work. Not on their own houses. They live in tents. They're nomads. They have nothing, really. And they stuck with that. Now, on the other hand, the reason why the Lord's name was being removed from the temple in Jerusalem, the reason why the Lord was deserting this place, was because the elders of Israel and Judah had not been so faithful as the Rechabites and had moved towards sumptuous living and Baal worship and alcohol and big houses and focusing on other things, and let the house of the Lord go to ruins. Now, their focus had gone the other way. So it's a great lesson that Jeremiah teaches them there. Great lesson. And they probably scoffed and ridiculed the Rechabites, and probably they were an object of derision in the history of Israel. But nevertheless, we're a great example of covenant, of truth, of fidelity, and of focus. And so they're rewarded and blessed. And so God speaks through Jeremiah in verse 18 and brings this blessing upon the whole house of the Rechabites, Midianites, mind you, not Israelites, who had been faithful to the cause. So Mark chapter 9. Now, what I'd like to have a look at here just briefly in Mark chapter 9 is a very special event that was taking place. And again, this is probably something that we kind of read through in the text and miss. And I'd like you to look at verse 32-33. They were in Galilee, actually, Jesus and his disciples. And we need to remember that the context and the sort of the history, the immediate history of this ninth chapter of Mark was the transfiguration that we read about in the earlier verses. And this was a pretty spectacular event, I think, for anyone, especially these three disciples, to be taken up into this mountain way up in the north part of Israel, this high mountain, and there transfigured, whatever that meant, these images of Moses and Elijah there with Jesus, dressed in shining white clothes. And a very special privilege. There was 12 disciples, and there were three of them that actually got to go up into the mountain. In verse 30, they left that place and passed through Galilee, and Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were. And the NIV says, because he was teaching his disciples. In the King James, I think it says he taught his disciples. What was the process was, he was in the process of teaching his disciples some very, very difficult things for them to understand. Now, we get a sense of this in the parallel passage in Matthew chapter 17 and verse 23, when Jesus specifically said to them, as he does here, that the Son of Man is going up to Jerusalem. He's going to be mocked. He's going to be spat upon. He's going to be crucified, killed and crucified, and he's going to rise the third day. And that's exactly what he's teaching them here. But in the Matthew record, it says that they were grieved. They were grieved by this. And I had an interesting time trying to figure out what that word grieved meant, whether they're really truly sorry or whether it's like, why do you keep on saying this? Like, you know, you say something over and over again and people get kind of ticked off by it. I don't know, but there seemed to be something of that in it. So here he was now teaching his disciples in Mark chapter 9 and verse 31. He said to them, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men and they will kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise. Which is an amazing statement of, simple statement of this eternal truth. But they did not understand, Mark observes. Matthew observed that they were grieved by it. They did not understand, Mark observed. And because of that, they were afraid to ask him about it. Now, if you turn over to Mark chapter 10 and verse 32, this was a common teaching with Jesus, with his disciples. He didn't teach them this in one place, in one single event. This was clearly a continuing event, because in Mark chapter 10 and verse 32, it says they were on their way to Jerusalem now. Left Galilee, were on their way to Jerusalem. And Jesus was leading the way. It's kind of just a little picture here of what salvation is all about, isn't it? The disciples going to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way. And the disciples were astonished. And while they followed him there, and he took them aside, you see, and said in verse 33, we're going up to Jerusalem. And they were probably going, yeah, right. Jerusalem, you know, it's a feast, and that's where you go. That's the big city. For the Lord dwells. And the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. And they will condemn him to death. And will hand him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And 3 days later he will rise again. That's the teaching. You know, that really is the teaching for us. The early apostles in the early chapters of Acts said that they preached Christ crucified. That's what they preached. Paul said that to the Corinthians. He preached Christ crucified. He preached the resurrection of the dead. Being a Christian is not about going to church. That's really what he's saying. It's about going to Jerusalem. That's what it's about. And when Jesus says, we're going up to Jerusalem and I'm leading the way, he's talking about service and he's talking about sacrifice and he's talking about shedding blood and dying. But hallelujah, he's talking about being raised from the dead. Now, verse 33 of Mark chapter 9, when they came to Capernaum, when he was in the house, he asked them, so what was it you guys were talking about on the road today? Now, they're embarrassed by this question, so they didn't answer him. They were embarrassed by this because, unhappily, they were arguing about who would be the greatest. They weren't meditating about what salvation was all about going to Jerusalem and about death and resurrection. They were arguing about why those three guys got to go up on the mountain, and they didn't. And here's the great lesson, isn't it, of salvation. It's not, as they say, about going to church. It's about going to Jerusalem. And we go to Jerusalem, we're talking about death and suffering and service. And we don't want to dwell entirely on that, and Jesus didn't either, because he said it's about resurrection. And it's these eternal truths, brothers and sisters, that are the greatest impediment to our learning, really. I think so. Mine especially. You like the account and the story of the disciples on the road, but this business about Jerusalem is difficult. It's difficult because we have self-interests and we have preconceived notions. That's generally what our life is all about. Like Solomon, it's self-interest, you know. 13 years in his own house and 7 on the Lord's and trying to focus on the Queen of Egypt, not the eternal God of Israel. The disciples had their self-interest, who would be the greatest, and their preconceived notions about Jerusalem. They saw Jerusalem as being power and sitting on 12 thrones. They didn't see Jerusalem as being sacrifice and shedding of blood. So Jesus tells them the truth again. I don't know whether they were listening. God willing, we listen. He sits them down. He puts a child in the midst of them. And he says, you guys want to be big? You want to be great? Now, the world's idea of being greatness is having, I don't know, 1,000 people working for you. We have a client who is a former CEO of IBM. And I kind of look at him and go, so? People say he's a former CEO of IBM. And I say, so? See? Because as far as Jesus is concerned, those aren't the great people in life. The people who are great are the people who work for others. Not the people who have a lot of people work for them, but the people who work for others. That's what it's all about. And I think, interestingly enough, the word child and servant, as I understand it in the Aramaic, means the same. It's child and servant means the same. So you can see that Jesus was drawing the strong picture here. Kids basically don't have preconceived notions. They learn. You know, you can teach them. We were at a building site the other day, and one of our staff had a bottle of really toxic stuff that he was using for wiping off some flashing, and it had a childproof lid on it. And I was trying to get this thing open. I couldn't get it open. And he says, Clyde, this, you know, those things, any kid would get that open in 10 seconds. You know, figure that one out in 10 seconds. But it's guys like us that take, you know, how did you push that down to there? So Jesus was really making that point, isn't he? Kids can learn things really fast. They don't have preconceived notions. And primarily they don't have as much self-interest, but these are the barriers. We grow up and we get preconceived notions, as did the disciples. But that brings us really to the emblems, doesn't it? That's what we need to acknowledge on Sunday morning and indeed every day of our life. That it's about these priorities. It's about self. It's not about self-serving. It's about getting rid of the self-serving. It's about putting behind us the preconceived notions. It's about giving the Lord the biggest share. Not following Solomon's example, but giving the Lord the biggest share. It's about being like the Rechabites who kept their covenant and weren't distracted. They didn't lose their focus. They stayed with it. It's about our need to give up our own concerns about who's great and who's working and who isn't. And it's about going to Jerusalem and serving the Lord. It's about putting Christ first. It's about putting Jerusalem first. It's about putting his sufferings first and his resurrection. It's about putting others first in our lives and ourselves second. That is the essence. That is the meaning of this moment that we share in this bread and wine.